for the 2018-19 division of revenue. Division of revenue. Secretary, are there apologies?
No, we cannot present the email.
Done. All the members, thank you again for your participation. Those who were present during last week's oversight in Gauteng, it was a very active program and also very informative. Building up to actually today's presentation, by the agency, it all fits together. If you look at all our previous engagements on the metros and the spending of grants, specific in our bigger settings. We will also be dealing with, you're going to buy everyone a chocolate. Please all phones on silent. We will also be dealing with the Power Tambo District Municipality, referring to a reply by the Honourable Minister of Finance after our engagement, as well as a reply from the Provincial Treasury from the Eastern Cape. What they did, if you remember, members, we gave them spaces that afternoon to engage with each other, which they did, plus a follow-up back in their province. So this is a report back by letter, and I requested the staff to also circulate to you those replies. As well, we will be dealing with the South African Reserve Bank. It falls under finance, but the finance committee is not meeting this week. Only appropriation today and tomorrow. The invitation to 10 October in Cape Town, where they will be addressing the public on monetary policy. And lastly, Honorable Motara, that will brief us on the program of the NCOP. And that is our schedule for this meeting. All members, urban areas are the economic engines of the country, as we experience with and in our engagements with some of the metros, and has a significant role to play with respect to the national development, also being addressed in the National Development Plan. And our action plan, how to enhance this development through our work in Parliament, our oversight outside, but also our engagement with other stakeholders, including the private sector. That's a very major role player in this whole exercise. To the FFC, Professor Pleitens and your whole team, welcome. National Treasury, Stephen Kenyon, welcome to you. We've got a gentleman there at the back with a computer. Just introduce yourself.
I'm Matt Johnson.
On your microphone, please.
I'm Matt Johnson from the organization on doing tax abuse.
Right. And we recognize also the PBO, Daniel Mundy. Thank you for being here. Prof, over to you. You can take us through. I know you must... board a flight just after 1 o'clock, so we don't intend to keep you here past 12 o'clock. Welcome again. You can take us through the briefing. Very important, members, before Prof starts, is also the document, of the book, which you have to work through. Now, if you take a budget review of February, and you take this and you match it up, very good documentation, which we also call as referral documents, reference documents, especially to students. Wish we had more students here from the universities to come and listen to these presentations. Prof, you can take us through. Thank you. I'm going to give you time until 11 o'clock.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable.
Is it enough time? Until 11, one more time.
We will probably get to that.
Right, 10 past 11, fine.
That should be okay. Chairperson and honourable members, good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Daniel Plankin. I'm the chairperson of the commission. I brought a commission as part of our field commission in Lobisi, Tipo Lobisi. So originally from Mpumalanga, the former chair, a former speaker in the Mpumalanga legislature.
Fantastic.
Is that one of the commissioners? Then I've got the secretariat team, which is Dr. Ramu Mabugu. Next team is Dr. Ramu, and then David's next team. Or ex-team, like some people are saying, who was our parliamentary officer. We had Safa Peters and Popin Ntsapa. All right, Popin. Okay.
Popin, welcome, Popin. You've got a strong team, Professor.
Yeah, thank you. Che, I'm actually happy that you just reminded the commission, the members of the committee, about the submission that you've made, the book, but also what's important is that, as I said, in the Free State, and today we on our way to Limpopo, so we're trying to keep the message as consistent as possible, that we have been challenged as to whether our submissions that we are making in Aquitania are making changes in provinces and in division of Embryo. And I'd like to remind this committee that we can make as many submissions and recommendations. If you yourself don't see the recommendations and submissions as a continuum of the path that we've made, this takes you back 2 years ago. We did one of the infrastructure growth. Last year we did the rural development, and this year to urban and urban cities. And in the past we did the same from a number of other submissions. You need to see the continuum of all those submissions first. Secondly, it's the responsibility of your committees and other committees to check the medium term of the policy statement in relation to our submission. And thirdly, is to check the submission in relation to the appropriation of the ministers, when this is a finance table. If you don't see the connection between that, then you're going to see our submissions publicly again in terms of what's happening. So we're asking you that you don't get into the same conversation that we had last year, where one of the members of the public committee said that they don't see the difference between what we're saying and what they're saying. We're saying many times different things to what they submitted. But it's incumbent on you, so we provide you with the information. We make suggestions and recommendations as to how the vision of the agency should look like, but that's where we stand back, because that's our responsibility. So it is incumbent on this committee to look at it, and we do that obviously in terms of the constitutional goal in the government of fiscal inflation, and also the money goal. What is important on this submission is that we're looking at to use the potential of accelerated urbanization using the government of fiscal inflation tools to drive positive transformation of the economy towards attainment of rapid economic growth that reduces inequality and eliminates poverty. Now, if you look at all our submissions over the years, it essentially addresses those 3 points: transformation of economic issues and tools, structure to get economic growth, and together inequality and poverty. So if you haven't made changes sometime, then you need to look at whether the policy recommendations made by us relative to what government is doing this day, how those things come together, or whether there's a classic disjunction between them. Just to take you to the next point, we'd like to confirm to you that urban areas I'm going to skip this slide, because what I want to ask the chair is just on the outline of the chip of the chapters. If you, when I hand over to Dr. Ramos, what we will do is the other presenters will just come online instead of just asking you to get your hand over, where you can hand over so we can get through the presentation. So
you would do that directly, almost to what?
So we've done that. So the submission is in three parts. What are the macroeconomic parameters of that underpins the urban development? We look at city level productivity, competitiveness, and well-being of residents. That's the whole issue around poverty and growth and economic development. and then look at specifically at the local government issues with the understanding, like you've been saying, southern areas are not the same situation as the northern. What we are wanting to confirm is that urban areas are important and account for 20% of the land. The proportion of urban population increasing at a rapid rate, leading to a gap between demand and supply of services. The more people coming into urban areas, there's a need to look at the services. We're very good to supply that. We see in many areas, especially in the sprawl of informal settlement areas, there are cracks that emerge in the relationship between demand and supply of urban services, so sometimes the changes are too much. Urban areas, again, to confirm the economic center, contribute to 60% of the GDP. We're looking at these two approaches, in particular drawing on South Africa's understanding of it. Urban, settlement, urban and rural, where urban is referring to formal and informal, and rural to traditional and rural. If you look at metro municipalities, we're talking about 63 municipalities. It's based off the metro, the B1s and the B2s, informal areas. We will skip the Malawi map because I think the Malawi family know how the African look like, and we're doing the urban areas. But here's an important slide. I don't think it's going to help in the short term there. But if you look at the shift from 2000 in the urban areas to 2011, you'll see that the rural population is becoming smaller. In the Western Cape, in the Northern Cape, in the Free State, and in a town like Gauteng, that's a small part of the rural area. Now, the reason why I mentioned those areas, Chair, is to show you those problems that we have discussed as rural areas. There's a need to look at what does that shift mean? Because people no longer live in the rural areas of the province, they're actually moving to the urban developed areas of the province. And as a result, there's a pressure happening in those areas. So probably one of these days we will no longer refer to these provinces as Northern Cape as a rural province. There might be a lot of land space, but it doesn't necessarily mean the rural provinces, because with urbanization growth, comparatively those services are defined in the urban area. The same with the Free State. You see that reduction from 2,000 people in the Free State in the rural areas, and now it's less than 400,000 people in the Free State in the rural areas. But it's still there. In some areas it's totally full of itself. On the economic growth, by now this committee is agreed by many that suggests that there's been a sluggish growth in the economy. The Minister of Finance also spoke about it yesterday with stats and data to confirm that we are relatively in trouble. Because if the economy doesn't grow, there's not enough tax and not the tax base of fiscal rent, and as a result there's a contraction around public spending. It then has an effect on procure interventions and policy programs up there. So we just wanted to demonstrate to you through those quarterly growth patterns that we've seen that we are in danger of not having enough fiscal responsibility. So it seems from our understanding, and how we get the numbers, that the fiscal consolidation will carry on for another few years. Luckily enough, that yet we see the fiscal consolidation. That seems to be to describe some poverty in dynamics by region. What we see that Africa, the confirmation of the middle income country, but obviously the inequalities are very deep. We're sitting at the Gini coefficient around 50.6, it may not sometimes to 0 to 70. So we are in trouble at this moment at the 0.68. So, but the issue is that we there's a need to recognize inequalities in Africa and keep levels of it, but it's also stubborn poverty and then obviously unemployment. So there's a need to find ways of how do we intervene as a country into historic matters about inequality. Because the inequality issue is around war of the economy, leverage issue about how we do intervention around poor people, in particular historically marginalized communities, African black and rural areas. So there's time to stand still and think about that. So our view is that when you get to the Ministry of Foreign Policy statement, please check these things again. Are we going to ever get in terms of the middle of the economy? That brings us to another slide that speaks to inequality. Can you go to the next one? We've managed to put it in a better way for you so that you all can see it, at least we can see it. I can't see some of the things. There you see the levels of inequality, the levels of Gini coefficient, 2015 and 2016. And you can see there that in the Western Cape it's slightly below 0.61 rather. The Eastern Cape is below, it's higher than that. Northern Cape is lower. Clearly also the population is lower there. The highest levels of inequality can be seen in housing and consumer costs. So the reality here of the slide shows is that inequality exists across the nation. It's a huge South African problem. And it requires intervention. So there's no problem that escapes the high level of inequality in the country. There we show you in terms of what are the metrics. And you can see that popular city in 2016 around the edge of the other provinces or other metro cities. But the point is, it's consistent with the surrounding provinces. We find ways of intervention there. Next slide. What we basically say is that there are, from our submission, there are prospective scenarios for economic consequences of economic interventions that we made from 2018 to 2020. And in particular, to look at the impact of long-term impact of shock and structural reforms on growth, employment, poverty, and equality. And as a result, we need to look at the medium-term framework. On how we want to show structural interventions on the economy. Chair, we say also to you that based on our assessment of the situation, we have a view that that stability in the macro economy has to underpin development, the spheres of government, and the fiscal space for accelerating development. Clearly there we need to look at how does this, we would say to you, when you engage with different levels of government, you look at how optimal people use the fiscal space, the budget, revenue and expenditure plans and economic policies to help with facility growth. We want to confirm that development is multidimensional.
and conflict with Sussex, and government by structural reform towards economic diversification, favourable or improving development standards, but also to balance rural and industrial spaces. Our submission speaks to very strongly to development planning coordination and how different spheres also set us in the state of the field. So our first set of recommendation is that improvement of infrastructure in the first instance will lead to lower cost of services. So if infrastructure is there and in place, then the cost of people getting to services, the cost of services being delivered to people are much cheaper. If you don't have a road, that takes you to a particular point where you can get services, and you don't have proper transport network to deliver the services, then it's conceivable that the cost of getting to work and the cost of getting to for people to spend in order to buy consumer goods and other forms of assets will be more expensive. But in a higher, in a short term, it will be higher spending. We need to recognize that. The infrastructure spending is quite costly. What we're saying is that if we follow through some of our proposals, then on infrastructure, but in particular urban development, that will definitely lead to a decline of the GDP efficiency generally. Why? Because there will be higher direct taxes, there will be lower consumer prices for poor households, and there will be a higher demand for informal labor. You see a dynamic effect, which is higher labor supply of unskilled labor. So if there's infrastructure investment, if there's a high forms of investment, then clearly it will draw on skills that to be provided. And we will draw the campaign on that. It doesn't seem to remind the other committee that we spoke to in MA about. It seems to me that when we, if I can assume that most of you are my age and older than me, hopefully, that during our time we were under the public workers that were employed by the municipal council, couldn't see that both incidents to the council and that. Question is where are all those jobs? Those jobs have disappeared over the years. And as a result, there's a low intensity of creating employment by having the municipalities and provinces, and there's a need to be kept. The firm recommendation that we make is that there's a need to continue with the gradual program of fiscal consolidation, because we showed that most of the members we spoke to yesterday confirmed the slightly gross fact constraints in the current numbers for the country. There's a need to implement implementation of significant capital investment in public infrastructure that has a positive impact on social sector, social factor productivity, and there's a need to develop and promote the development of urban innovation. The pipeline is moving to urban initiatives and policy coordination, promoting productive social safety nets like education provision, non-contributed income like social grants, but also need to look at health provision. And there's obviously the need to look at the impact of the NSR and some of the colleagues who talked about it. Chair, I would like to now turn over to Dr. Ramos.
Thank you. Moving on to chapter 2, this that's a very simple thing. It's about assessing integrated urban development framework and the city support program to see if those two main policies and planning processes and practices are indeed a sound an adequate response to urbanization challenges at the level of metropolitan cities. So that's the key essence of this chapter, an assessment of those two main interventions by government to the challenge. Now, what we find from that in-depth assessment runs along three main streams. The first is that the city support program has got a very strong coordination element to it, where national government works quite closely with the metropolitan areas to ensure economic growth and a reduction in poverty. So the coordination element and the funding instruments around that are well knit together. Coming to the integrated urban development framework, our assessment is that it has learned quite a lot from previous experiences with the urban development framework, where it has been more inclusive and consultative. So they've identified good coordination structures and also acknowledged that COPTA will play the lead role in integrated urban development framework and for collaborating with other stakeholders. But what we find missing with the integrated urban development framework is that there is no specified or unique national funding instrument to accompany the integrated urban development framework. And so as a result is that so the integrated urban development framework is well coordinated building on the experiences from the urban development framework. But what it doesn't have is a specified or ring-fenced national funding instrument that is the main disjuncture that we have identified in the assessment in chapter 2. So as a result, we make two recommendations to address those findings. The first is to continue with the strengthening of coordination and monitoring mechanisms. And the second one is to find a way of consolidating the urban development related grants and pairing them with the both integrated urban development framework and cities support program, so that we have coherent frameworks that have specific funding instruments associated with them. Chapter 3 picks up on the work that we did in 2011 around how to make cities more compact. And this time around, we are not trying to make the case for compaction, but because that's what we did in 2011. Our objectives this time are to say, since 2011, we've seen a battery of legislation and policies, all with a view of making cities more compact. How have we fared up to so far since 2011? Are we on track to a compaction? And for us, a compact city is very straightforward to understand. Our understanding of a compact city that we're using here is a high-density urban settlement with the following main characteristics: central area revitalization, high-density development, mixed-use development, where services and facilities such as hospitals, parks, schools, leisure and fun are all grouped around the same area so that you benefit from having integrated transport networks, etc., etc. So you reduce cost of service delivery by bringing development within a specified constrained area. So again, in terms of our findings in assessing how interventions have failed since at least 2011, three strings of main findings. From our conversations with senior managers in the metropolitan areas, our assessment is that they demonstrate a clear understanding of compaction, and that is also shown in the frameworks and guidelines that they put together. So there isn't a main issue from the normal side perspective to ask, do you have an understanding of compaction or do you have frameworks and guidelines in place? They have got those, and we could verify that most of the metros to a high degree that could understand. But we found that there are no incentives or specific funding instruments for compaction. Again, almost similar to the second chapter, that although the metro has done well in terms of preparing the frameworks and the guidelines, but no specific funding instrument for compaction, compact, on its own, as opposed to the other area of special development framework that can have a specific funding instrument. The method that we consulted held a very strong view that compaction could be more efficiently funded through an incentive grant, which is similar to the built environment performance plan. They had that very strong view. So in terms of our recommendations here, we call on the introduction of an incentive grant that is specifically targeted for city compaction to make sure that it doesn't get diluted in the whole scheme of things. So a well-specified, targeted for city compaction incentive grant is the main recommendation to address the disjunction that we have found from assessing where we are going the wrong way with compaction. Session.
Thanks, Samuel. The next chapter 40 relates to public transport and the potential of urban municipalities to generate additional sources of funding. And the starting point for our analysis is the provisions contained in the National Land Transport Act. Now, according to this act, in order to facilitate better planning and implementation of an integrated public transport system, but also to encourage a more compact city form, what Dr. Mabogo was just talking about, this act allows for urban municipalities to take off to assume public transport functions. However, what we notice is that the pace at which urban municipalities have been assuming this full set of public transport functions has been very slow, and the reason for this has centered around funding constraints. So this chapter asks two main questions. Firstly, what is the extent to which financial constraints are part of the reason for the slow uptake of these functions? And secondly, can an urban municipality's own resources of revenue play a role in supplementing existing funding streams and in so doing speed up the assumption of these transport functions? In terms of the findings, firstly, our analysis confirms the existence of a funding gap between what is required by urban municipalities to implement and manage public transport versus the funding that is available. And the funding that is available to your urban municipalities comprises own revenue, intergovernmental transfers, and this is mainly your public transport network grant, and then public transport fees. Secondly, our analysis shows that alternative sources of income, most notably the fuel levy, parking levies and tariffs, and congestion charges, have the ability to generate additional income that can be directed towards funding public transport. However, such is the extent of the funding gap that even if urban municipalities generate this additional revenue, it will still be insufficient to close that funding gap. As a result, national transfers will still be required to support public transfers in urban municipalities. Instead, what we need to consider is reducing the cost of public transport as an approach to closing that funding gap. So there are three recommendations stemming from that chapter. Firstly, we recommend a review of the public transport network grant to investigate options to shift sources of funding towards retaining locally earned revenue. Secondly, we recommend that the Department of Transport should approve and pilot the consolidation of public transport functions within a well-capacitated city. And thirdly, we recommend that the Department of Transport should support the development of approaches or options that can assist in shifting us towards a more integrated approach to public transport. Moving on to chapter 5. The next set of recommendations relates to human settlement. And the two figures on that slide graphically illustrate the housing challenge facing your cities. So what the bar graph shows is growth in the urban population for the years 2001, 2011, and 2015. And what we can see is that the growth in the urban population across your metros is positive. And alongside this, the line graph shows the decline in the percentage of new properties registered. So together, these figures illustrate the gap between the percentage growth in households on the one hand and the percentage growth in housing delivery. So the aim of this chapter of the submission was to understand the implications of urbanization on housing needs. Now, in terms of the findings of our analysis, the first finding relates to the housing gap in urban municipalities. And the bar graph on that slide aligns the number of unhoused households to different income groups. And basically what that figure shows is that the highest number of unhoused households is concentrated within households earning between 4,000 and 9,000 rand per month. And this falls squarely in your gap housing market. Now, there is a specific subsidy program known as the Finance Linked Individual Subsidy Program, or FLIP, that is targeted at assisting those that fall within the gap housing market. But given that your urban municipalities are sitting with a significant amount of unhoused population, despite there being the subsidy program, we investigated further to understand what factors hamper the effectiveness of the FLIP. And what we found, firstly, is inconsistencies with respect to the implementation of that finance-linked individual subsidy program. According to housing policy, the FLIP should be rolled out by the National Housing Finance Corporation, but this is not being adhered to across all the provinces. Secondly, we found inconsistencies in the funding of the FLIP across the different provinces. Generally, provincial departments are not using the medium-term strategic framework targets for FLIP to underpin the funding of the program. Thirdly, we also identified an important policy gap whereby qualifying individuals who are single but cannot prove that they have financial dependence are effectively excluded from receiving that subsidy. Finally, we found that poor coordination exists between human settlements-related infrastructure programs and other key departments such as transport and education. So, of course, this type of silo approach hampers the goal of creating more compact cities, as explained in Chapter 3. So there are two key recommendations coming out of this chapter. First, we recommend a review of the FLIP with a view to broadening the base of qualifying beneficiaries and also to bring about more standardized implementation of that program. Secondly, we recommend that provincial human settlements departments need to ensure closer alignment between their delivery plans and those of other key departments such as provincial departments of education and transport. Chapter 6 of the submission looks at learner mobility and how this impacts education planning and funding. And just in terms of sketching the problem, what we see is the process of learners switching schools both within and across municipal and provincial boundaries. And basically this switching mimics your urban development patterns where the majority of your learners are concentrated in your urban areas, especially your metros, where the quality of education is perceived to be better. And the key reason that the FSC investigated this issue is because these school migration patterns have fiscal implications in that they affect the distribution of allocations, particularly with respect to the provincial equitable share allocation amongst the provinces. And then also from a planning perspective, an urbanizing school population results simultaneously in underutilization of schooling resources in the sending area, whilst creating overcrowding in the receiving area. So the key question underpinning our analysis here is to what extent are education transfers, and we focus specifically on the provincial equitable share allocation and education conditional grants. We looked at how responsive are these transfers to learner mobility. And in terms of our key findings, next slide. The overall picture that emerges is that four provinces in the main have experienced significant changes in the total share of enrollment. So what we see is that the Eastern Cape and Limpopo are the main sending provinces, and Gauteng and the Western Cape are the largest receiving provinces. We also found that mobility increases with grade progression, so learners tend to change their place of residence when reaching higher grades or secondary schooling. And this is an important finding, especially for school infrastructure in your receiving provinces. Then with respect to funding education, the provinces generally rely on the provincial equitable share allocation to fund education. Now, the PES allocation is allocated to provinces using a formula consisting of six components, and the education component accounts for 48% of the PES allocation. And this component is allocated based on school enrollment and school age population. Because generally what we should find is that more funding goes to provinces with bigger populations. And what our analysis shows is that the provincial equitable share has been responsive to learner migration patterns. One concern that arose is that we saw that after adjusting for migration, so after the receiving province gets a little bit extra, the sending province gets a downward or reduction in the allocation, what we see is that the per capita allocations are similar between the sending and receiving provinces. And this raises concerns from an equity point of view, especially given that the biggest sending provinces are the Eastern Cape and Limpopo. So these are generally poorer, more rural provinces. So the way in which the formula adjusts in response to learner migration patterns fails to account for the continuous spending needs of the sending provinces. Then with respect to infrastructure grants, we find that they disproportionately benefit receiving provinces. So what we're seeing is a shift away from the previous prioritization of infrastructure backlogs, which saw the likes of your Eastern Cape and Limpopo receiving significant allocations, towards a funding approach that appears to respond to growing urban learner populations. So what we see is housing experiencing the highest growth in the education infrastructure grant allocation. Finally, what we noted is that the issue of learner mobility is not well managed, and the reason for this is because provincial infrastructure plans do not factor in spatial demographic shifts. The fact that learners are moving around thus affecting utilization of infrastructure is not something that gets strategic consideration. So there are three recommendations coming out of that chapter. The first is that we recommend that a weighted learner socioeconomic profile be incorporated into the education component of the PES. And this can serve as an additional cushion for poorer, more rural sending provinces that face downward adjustments as a result of learner migration. Secondly, to foster greater alignment between education infrastructure and overall provincial infrastructure, we recommend that the framework for the education infrastructure grant incorporate the need for provincial infrastructure plans to take into account spatial demographic patterns. Finally, with respect to that chapter, we recommend that learners be allocated with unique identification numbers, and we believe that this can help to ensure that funds follow learners as they move between schools, and that it can also assist in tracking of learner migration patterns. Moving on to chapter 7. This chapter looks at what government can do to stimulate growth in urban municipalities. And this is important given that your cities are the engines of economic growth, accounting for over 40% of GDA. Cities can also play a big role in helping to reduce poverty, inequality and unemployment, and it is for these reasons that it's important to design and implement policies that are capable of maximizing the potential of urban economies. Also, when we look at the National Development Plan, there's really a leaning towards if urban municipalities are to play this big role in generating inclusive growth, the LED, the local economic development strategies, should focus on promoting diversification of economic activities. So in this chapter of the annual submission, we carried out an empirical analysis to determine what the most important factors affecting the economic performance of urban municipalities are, and we place particular focus on industrial diversity. From a policy angle, we noted that the National Treasury City Support Program and the Department of Trade and Industry's Industrial Policy Action Plan, they both incorporate aspects aimed at enhancing diversity. And we believe our analysis is important as it seeks to really define the exact nature of the diversity growth relationship in South Africa. Also, we see that potential links between industrial structure, so how diversified or specialized your economic activities are, they are likely to vary across provinces, and importantly, from an intergovernmental fiscal relations perspective, what we are interested in is whether more industrially diversified regions perform better than more specialized ones. Moving to the next slide, please. So the key finding here is that we see a positive relationship between industrial diversity and economic performance of municipalities. So diversification matters for growth. There are also other findings relating to the importance of human capital and economic performance, but that positive relationship between industrial diversity and economic performance is the key finding, and it's what informs our recommendation. On the next slide, please. So there's a single recommendation coming out of this chapter, and it relates to the establishment of an economic diversification fund that should be focused on supporting cities in promoting spatial transformation and economic growth. I'll hand over to Poppy.
Thank you, Chair. The next set of recommendations relates to the effects of municipal spending on urban employment. And then what we see is that despite the widely held perception that unemployment levels tend to be lower in the urban centers compared to the rest of the country, the reality is that they're actually quite high, if not as high as the national average, as is illustrated in the graph below. But at the same time, what we see is that your absorption rates in these urban municipalities are also quite high. Moving on to the next slide. So what we're trying to say is that while the responsibility for job creation is primarily the role of national government to promote job creation, while the responsibility for job creation is primarily the role of national government, your municipalities have various fiscal levers at their disposal that they can use to promote job creation, be it in an indirect way. So in other words, urban municipalities with their relatively higher labor absorption rates may offer an avenue through which this unemployment challenge could be alleviated. So what this chapter sought to do was to examine the indirect effects of municipal spending programs on job creation. Moving on to the next slide, in terms of the key findings, what we see or what we found was that spending on the expanded public works program and spending on the community works program has a positive effect on the total level of employment for metros, but not for your secondary cities and your large towns. So that is to say that whilst it is by design, your EPWC is intended to create short-term job opportunities as opposed to long-term employment, the program has the potential to create economic value through spillover effects, but these gains, as we see, are largely enjoyed by your metros because that's where your EPWP opportunities are largely concentrated. And the next finding was that infrastructure spending to ensure no statistical significance for the urban municipalities, which is quite surprising given that it's regarded as a key determinant of employment and economic growth, and given the context of an infrastructure-led growth strategy. In terms of our recommendations, there were two. We recommend that the employment creation role of the NPWP should be expanded to specifically target your secondary cities and your large towns so that they can also enjoy the gains of your spillover effect as a metro. And secondly, we recommend that an assessment of the expanded public works program integrated grant for municipalities should also be assessed, or an assessment should be carried out. Moving on to the next set of recommendations, Chapter 9, it looks into the policy orientation and the existing funding as it relates to urban informal employment. And as has been highlighted in the previous chapter, our cities remain the centers of attraction for many people in search of job opportunities and in social services. So in the absence of formal employment growth, we can then say that your urban informal employment can be expected to remain the employer of last resort for most of unskilled migrants in the medium to the long term. So what this chapter sought to do was to address three questions. The first being, how significant is the urban informal sector in contributing to urban employment? Secondly, what role do provinces and your cities play in assisting informal employment? And thirdly, what is the role of fiscal instruments in enhancing informal employment? Moving on to the next slide, in terms of the key findings of the research, we found that informal employment is not growing at the rate that is consistent with the high levels of unemployment. If you consider that unemployment is around 25% on average when you look at it across the cities, and informal employment only constitutes around, or the informal sector contributes around 16 or 17% of the total employment. Where the main constraints of this relate to strict regulations, the lack of access to services, and finance. The findings also further indicate that whilst there's a range of available informal sector support opportunities, but in support policies, these policies are, however, not sufficiently designed and coordinated to address the specific growth impediments experienced by your informal enterprises if we take or if we look at it from a more holistic point of view. In particular, your local government approaches for dealing with informal employment or enterprises are predominantly regulatory, and where the informal sector is perceived as homogenous and comprising of only trade activities. And secondly, national and provincial policies are not backed up by requisite funding allocations. And thirdly, existing funding programs appear to operate independently with emphasis on central administration. So in terms of the key recommendations, we made three, we recommend that there be a consolidation regularizing into long-term budget line items and to decentralize the different funding programs. Secondly, we recommend that the various departments must invest in a grant beneficiary information management system so as to minimize double dipping and to monitor the impact of various funding support programs. And thirdly, we recommend that existing financial and non-financial support programs holistically address informal enterprise growth constraints. And moving on to the next set of recommendations, which is Chapter 10, and it relates to ICT and city governance, with the understanding that in order for municipalities to fulfill their core mandate, which is to deliver basic services, municipalities need to firstly run a basic administration. Secondly, they need to ensure that rapid urbanization and the resultant increased demand for service delivery does not stifle the ability to deliver on these services effectively and efficiently. So one avenue through which efficient administration can be realized is through an ICT-led approach. So given this, the research underlying the set of recommendations sought to investigate the extent to which urban municipalities prioritize spending on trying to improve internal operations and city governance, and to understand the benefits and challenges of an ICT-led approach to city governance. In terms of the key findings of the research, we found that metros tend to spend a larger share of the operating expenditure on ICT relative to secondary cities and in large towns. And then the second finding was that the extent to which priority was attached to ICT depended on your buy-in and the support of your senior management, and whether or not they saw value in using ICT. And then thirdly, in a major issue that arose in the interactions we had with municipalities regarding ICT relates to the implementation of the Municipal Standard Chartered Accounts in SCOA, which is a local government financial management reform to be uniformly implemented across all municipalities, where your municipalities are to move away from numerous standalone legacy systems to systems that allow for greater integration. And what emerged was that the implementation of MSCOA was largely ICT intensive. And the second finding was that there was actually no specific funding instruments that were available for municipalities to fund the implementation of these national regulations, whereas the financial management grant, for example, does not allow for MSCOA to be implemented, but rather the majority of the municipalities that we interacted with indicated that the grant was largely focused on the placement of, for example, your finance-related interns. So in terms of our recommendations, we made two. We recommended that we ensure that the allocations for assisting municipalities with regards to the municipal standard charts of accounts implementation through the financial management grant be ring-fenced and deliberately biased towards your lesser-resourced urban municipalities. And the second recommendation is to ensure that technical assistance is provided to lesser resource municipalities to be assisted with change management. And with that, Chair, if I can hand over to Commissioner Mbisi, who will take us through the last set of recommendations.
Thank you. The next set of recommendations is looking at own revenue diversification for financing of urban municipalities. We looked at the contextual urban challenge here, which is the twin challenges of rapid urbanization and slow economic growth, plus a standard property tax is placing tremendous fiscal pressures on the nation's urban municipalities, and also challenging the challenging ability of local government to continue their current levels of public services. And that the secondary cities and metros in particular require more resources to invest in infrastructure in order to attract new investment and build dynamic economies. Economies, infrastructure, employment, so that they can create employment and create vibrant municipalities and improve livelihoods. As urban challenges increase, so does the need for financial resources. Although the 29 largest cities chair have demonstrated significant fiscal effort of relative to other categories of municipalities, own revenue sources are insufficient to meet their obligation and requirements. And then, Chair, we have then identified three findings in particular, that large towns need to diversify revenue resources
and that there is no municipality credit rating mechanism at the moment, and that the second is that pooling finance mechanism, that is, we are talking about municipalities that share inter alia a similar vision and credit characteristics coming together to access public sector funding to issue bonds and joint access bank finance can satisfy most of the principles that define a good revenue option for large cities. And the third one is that land value capture, which is what we mean, is that seeing the positive impact of municipal investment on land values and to use such funds as a source for financing projects are a potential source of revenue for large cities and successful implementation of these mechanisms. And the successful implementation of this mechanism largely depends on proper design of lazy and clear legal framework, effective land use management systems, and well-trained and capacitated person charged with its implementation, and efficient and accurate and timely land valuation. And then the last one would be the public-private partnerships, which I think have been spoken to. And our recommendation, Chair, is that we should improve national treasury, should improve access to credit markets. And the second one would be that national treasury improves the public-private partnerships deal flows within municipalities. This has been found to be a that cumbersome process of the triple P. If they can be streamlined using the financial management grant to build capacity and incentivize public-private partnerships through adopting a national facility for financing feasibility studies. And the last one would be national treasury should create awareness of land value capture fiscal instruments among large That concludes our submission for this year. So we'd like to ask again from you if when you see the meetings about the policy statement and the budget statement itself, if you can measure it against that so that you can actually see whether we've actually added value to the process. Thank you, Chair. That concludes.
Thank you, Professor Weike and your team. Stephen, you are King Solomon. You have need a lot of wisdom. Honourable members, this is a very important presentation. If you look at the tax and DAPA that was held yesterday in Gauteng, you will sense that revenue is under pressure. And if revenue is under pressure, there are less money to divide between the three spheres of government in terms of the division of revenue above that we will be dealing with in February 2018. So the hard message is spend the money you have wisely and very, very effectively and see how you can put things together, a combination of programs and funding to get a better result. This is a very, very important message to every sphere of government. Stephen, do you want to come in now? There will be official response by the Minister and the National Treasury, as we are used to in the Division of Revenue, but always here in the middle of the document, also captured in the budget review. Honourable members on their questions. You will see how this briefing relates to what we did last week, where we actually went to the ground and see what is happening, referring to the human settlement development, those mega cities. If you've got time, Prof, and your team, go to Johannesburg Metro, Diepsloot. It was very disturbing for us to see houses and flats go up, and here's a huge spike running over this development. From that hill to that hill. And when we asked them, what is this? Is it bulk water supply? They said, no way. This is bulk sewage. Running through a development where people must live. Yes. So I don't know. That planning, I'm putting a question mark there. I'm very disturbed about it. I would like to say that. It's about the dignity of the people. Yes. I've been carried away. Honourable members, let's take questions. Honourable Zumandi. Zumandi, first row. Second row, Honourable Advance. Excuse me. And Honourable Essa from the beautiful province of Mpumalanga. In that order?
Yeah.
Sorry, Dr. Matema, sorry. Sorry, I missed you, sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and I note and appreciate as you say the presentation. But the observations, Chair, that I'm making, and I'm glad that the Prof is making this kind of plea. That there should be recognition of the value that they are adding. But in the context of, you know, the recommendations that they are putting, now, that was my mind trying to clear it, is that what role really this submission is trying to play? Is it to advocate for more resources to people that are supposed to self-sufficient economically? The move is that these municipalities in the urban areas, Chair, we were informed last week that the you know, 57% of the, I mean, 57% of growth, economic growth, is in the urban area sphere. And so, what is the relationship then of these recommendations advocating for more money in my country? I might be wrong, Chair, but from what I'm asking, from where I sit, is that there's more advocacy from the commission to put more money. And I'm not too sure if the research did take cognizance of the narrowing of the cake of the revenue. And in chapter 2, one of the recommendations is to consolidate all those grants that are captured there. And they talk to the fact that, my question there would be then, is this what the cities want? But it's clearly advocating for more money. I mean, we would ask for Durban to get more money, Tshwane, Ekurhuleni, Cape Town, and Johannesburg. But I'm not too sure whether it's financially prudent, you know, to really ask for that money. The same thing in Chapter 4, Chair, the transport grants there, it's more money because they can't suffer waterfall and those kind of things. So in essence, are we real in the context of where we are in the economy? It's the observation I'm making, and I hope they would make a comment to that effect. And in chapter 5, Chair, where I think it's human seconds, and the various options that are given. So there is a sector, obviously I come from that sector. I hope there is something that talks to access to housing for your, what it seems to be diminishing leeway of the accessibility of those houses that are built. The unit a standard chair. If you are using a wheelchair or you're living with children that are with disabilities, so I think what is their observation and assessment there in as far as the applicability of what they are recommending to those additional requirements on the grant itself, the flexibility, is it covered? On sixth chair, I have to wear a provincial hat in that they talking of learner mobility chair. And the question that comes to my mind is, they highlighted Eastern Cape and Limpopo. When we visited KZN through the provincial week, the department presented to the delegation chair an anomaly, obviously on the issues of equitable share and the allocation for Pelena. In KZN we had the highest numbers of children in school of learners. We were 2.8. Gauteng was next to just 2 million or just under 2 million and the rest of the province each. But the money that we got as a result of the sense of change, that members will remember, that we then went downgraded in terms of the calculation of the population, but the money to the learners it doesn't recognize the fact that that section of the population is because I would like to get some more clarity and related to the chair. And I think they're recommending some kind of identity allocation on the child so that you track the mobility of the children. I agree with that. But we also having a report chair that says you have about 15,000 disabled children that are not in schools, so to speak. And in their view and related to that change that I'm not too sure they've done work in relation to the applicability and the relevance of a standardized subsidy that doesn't allow you pay for an early childhood child is 15 rand or 16 rand, and it's not relevant for a disabled child, and it would so be also with a learner in that category, whether it's high school program. So have they applied their mind of the components and the diversity of children? I mean, of the population where they make this recommendation. And then the same thing at chapter 7, I think, it's economic chapter. I think that they're talking about, and their call there is economic fund establishment of an economic fund. So I'm continuously making this point of advocating for allocation of resources to urban centers that are supposed to be sustainable on their own. I had a point on own revenue I think if there's time, I'll come back to it because I have to rearrange it. But I noted that I had a content on the own revenue section. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
That was a mouthful, Honorable Samandi. Yes, Honorable De Vaart, then Honorable Essart, then Dr. Matebe.
Chairperson, thank you. Let me start by really congratulating the team for this comprehensive presentation. I really think this is a mouthful. But me as a layman, I'm not an economist, but I'm a businessman. And you know, the feeling that I have, and please, this is not criticism, I just need some clarity. You know, there's nothing in this report that will sort of, you know, stimulate me or move me to go and start a new business or add to my business or whatever. My concern is, and that is a question, and the Honourable Louis already touched on that. Are we advocating more public funding that needs to be spent? And if that's the case, where are that money going to come from? Are we advocating that we need to make additional loans? And where are we going to get that? I think all of us are aware that the fiscal cliff, we are faced with a fiscal cliff already. So are we saying that we need to get some additional money from somewhere? And if so, where must it come from? Chairperson, I haven't heard a lot about new policies. Maybe the government must go back to the drawing board and decide how are we going to manage ourselves out of this mess where we are at the moment. I haven't seen anything yet. That is, as far as I'm concerned, Chairperson, with all due respect, a very good academic desktop exercise, what we have in front of us. You know, we have heard about of an integrated public transport system. What do we mean about that? You know, we are coming back, we are back now, we visited, you know, three big metros. They're only scratching the surface at the moment. They haven't even started communicating with one another. We don't have a proper public transport system in this country at all. People are battling to get at their work. So what are we talking about? And how are we going to roll it out? Chairperson, I really think that what is needed, and I think we are all aware that we seriously need to grow this economy. We need to generate extra funds. We need to generate extra revenue. And I haven't seen a lot here that is really exciting me at the moment. So, to be honest, as I said, I don't think if you take Cook enough, or Barry's or wherever, that is going to make one hell of a difference there to get their economies to grow. So I think we need something more to the point. We need something to the point, maybe a 3 or 2 point plan, where people can focus on and start driving that forward. This is a huge chunk. This is a typical elephant, and you can only eat a chunk by chunk. I don't think people can go out and go implement all this stuff. This is just not possible. They don't have the money for that. And as I said, this is certainly not ignite the appetite of the private sector to start investing. Thank you, Chairman.
Honourable Essart, then Dr. McKenna.
Chairperson, thank you. I find the presentation year on year by the Fiscal Finance Commission always very, very interesting in that you present to us basically sketches, pictures, and then obviously, you know, allude to your few discussions that you have had with National Treasury, and we move from there on. This is something I will read just now, just a comment which I thought was very interesting and maybe
gentleman across the occasion. Chairperson, there's some strong statements in the opening remarks where you say the economy is unable to grow at a pace that can markedly reduce inequality, poverty, and unemployment. Now, again, with due respect, together you and I, we've heard that time and time again. The question is, I guess, that the problem lay with us as politicians in terms of what are we going to do to resolve this comment. But that's just an opening comment. I see the slide is not marked, Chairperson, but it's not serious. You mentioned it is unclear whether the pattern of growth in South Africa has been pro-poor. I just need to be educated again and need to understand that just in simple layman's terms. Why are you saying this exactly? And then, Chairperson, I want to move on quickly. I had a few comments, but Honorable Lindsay Monday obviously interrogated the entire presentation chapter by chapter, and he probably will come back for a second bite, so he's covered some of what I wanted to ask. But nevertheless, be as it may be, considering the ongoing rising unemployment, you alluded to the fact that you have recommended to COFTA to consolidate the urban development related grants. Now, for how long have you been recommending this? What is the will? Then, quickly to give others an opportunity, Chairperson, the question on, yes, in your discussions with National Treasury, I'd like to just find out, I mean, how serious are they about the plans regarding over the midterm to ensure the strengthening of the mechanisms regarding the monitoring of the local spatial plans, etc., which you alluded to in the presentation, specifically regarding the priorities in metros. I trust you're capturing what I'm saying. If you're not clear, I can always expand. Okay. And then finally, Chairperson, I'm just surprised. You alluded to the credit rating of municipalities. Now, you know, after 23 years into our newfound dispensation, how come there hasn't been a will, whether it's through National Treasury or through COFTA, how come nothing concrete has really been done thus far regarding a program and a set of rules to be put into place regarding the credit rating of municipalities? Because surely this is having a huge impact on the economy across various spheres of government. Chairperson, thank you. Dr. Matema.
Chairperson, thank you very much. And I must apologize for coming the time I did, but we did discuss, you and me. Chairperson, personally, I think maybe we mustn't shoot the messenger. That is the impression I'm getting here. As I'm seated here, I was asking myself, are we backing at the correct tree, or what are we doing? But on the positive side, Chair, the fact that we are presented with research findings, Chair, says to us the information is not some fact. That is the reality of the situation which is being presented to us. The one constructive criticism I have is that, yes, this research is based probably on information we have in the offices. And this research seeks to help South Africa use the resources better. That's the message I think we are getting here. Land is finite. We can't grow this country by an inch or whatever. It's just that big. And so is the fiscus as well. But the one dilemma which I think faces the presenters here and every aspect of our life as South Africans is the fact that the warm bodies that services have to be provided for are those that appear in the books. That those that are documented, we're planning on the documented people that we know. If I may also wear my provincial cap, Limpopo, if you go to Musina, how many South Africans are there? I think the South Africans are outnumbered by far, by non-South Africans. But how many are the non-South Africans? No one can say with certainty how many actually those people are. It's a dilemma of our time. And I think every part of this country that shares a border with another country will have a similar experience like Limpopo is having there in Mosena. But Chester said, it's not all doom and gloom. It's not all doom and gloom. Oh, the document, okay, it's chapter 6. I don't know what to say about the page. Historically, I see here Eastern Cape, Gauteng, Limpopo. Historically, the areas of greatest need in South Africa have always been Eastern Cape, Limpopo, KZN. So my brother here, according to this research, KZN is graduating. Yes, KZN is graduating. KZN is getting somewhere, maybe slowly. Yes.
Order.
No. Okay. I'm interpreting what I'm seeing here. So, I was saying it's not all doom and gloom. The message which I'm getting from the presentation is that yes, the cake is only this big, but let us use it, let us share it correctly. Chairperson, then it takes us to the systems that we have, it takes us to the quality of personnel we have in our offices. It just takes us to how well are we managing the issues. Chairperson, I was lastly, as I'm seated here, I was grappling with the issue of time frames. But then I answered myself that for sure the time frames will belong to the implementers, the departments. The presentations here are saying to us, this is the reality. These are the challenges. These are the possible solutions. A time frame probably will be coming from the department. So in my own view, Chair, I really appreciate the type of work the team is doing because they are enabling South Africa not to shoot in the dark. They are enabling South Africa to know where the pressure points are. And they also propose possible solutions, Chairperson. And overall, like I'm saying, we're getting somewhere, but very, very slowly. We do have complicating factors like the inflow of non-South Africans whose number we do not know. But they will call at the clinic for health services. They will call at the schools. Children will be taken to schools. They access the services. They will go for their parents. pension grants, etc. Those are the challenges, Chairperson. But let us appreciate. Let's appreciate the information we are giving here. The messenger is saying to us, this is your message. Challenges are these. These are the possible solutions. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Member, Section 220 of the Constitution, page 133, says the following. There is an FFC for the Republic which makes recommendations in this chapter or in national legislation to Parliament, provincial legislators and any other authorities determined by the national legislation. They are here to make recommendations. It's our responsibility to engage with the relevant sector departments, national, provincial, and then go to our municipalities in terms of the action plan, the APPs, budgets, etc., to interrogate, is policy being implemented, yes or no? Because the money is there. Why did 9 provinces return to the National Treasury 4.4 billion rand. We went through that exercise. Now, question time is coming up in October to the economic cluster. This document sets the table for you to go and ask the questions to the relevant ministers and departments. Thank you, FSC. You gave us this appetite. Second, we're going to engage on the 26th of October with the MTBBS being briefed by the Minister of Finance and his team. There's the other opportunity. Calling the National Treasury and COFTA on the Back to Basics program, referring to economic growth in municipalities. How did this basics program enhance the performance in municipalities and metrics? Also looking at the MISA program. Then, to our research unit, a content advisor, this must be read together with the findings of the OECD, Organization for Economic Coordination and Development, and the report of the IMF and World Bank. May 2017, yes. This is not a standalone exercise. What does those institutions say about us? Yes, Dr. Matema, it's not all a gloomy picture. There are green shoots in the economy. We must just see it and take the message a step further. So, Professor Plyce, it's over to you, Stephen. I'm going to give you the opportunity also to come in. Yes.
I apologize. Before we allow them to respond, can I just give a second bite?
No, not yet. There's no question to respond.
Okay.
I want the chances of the 12th person. Engagement at 12:30 with the Chief Whip. Honorable Gaylor, you came late, but I understand.
Yeah, no, my thanks for that. No, I was just on your comment.
Remember the local council.
On your comment, Chairperson, now that the austerity return for 4 billion, that's what you say.
Yeah.
And you say we must ask the questions to the ministers. I'm worried now when you say we must ask the questions to the ministers, because when you ask those questions, they don't answer, that you know very well. You don't get a relevant answer from the ministers. So why should we waste our time and ask them when they don't answer?
Then you keep on asking. Professor Plyce, and then Treasurer.
Well, thank you, Chairperson. You could probably ask the Finance and Fiscal Commission to ask those questions on your behalf. Given our constitutional responsibility. Chair, thank you for the comments, but I thought that let's be as blunt and as brutally honest with each other.
Yes.
If Because I think there's so much driving that's been happening over the last years, but more importantly, there's if you tangle in the dark, you in conceivably kind of walk on each other's feet. So here's the point that I would like to make. The Free State started asking us, the members of the Free State asked us possibly similar questions and comments. Honourable, before I come to Honourable Zamandi's comment and stuff and respond to it, Honourable Pastor Matera, thank you very much for that. We're going to, for your comments, we're going to Limpopo this afternoon. So we will hear some more of the questions coming through. Honourable de Blanche, you know, we need to have a conversation sometime about the discourse of language. Because when people say with due respect, I mean, there's a lot of issues that sits in it. I think South Africans sometimes use phrases with due respect, but in reality, it's actually a backhand to what you are saying. And we need to talk about that. And I want to remind members here that, and it's sometimes useful, sometimes not useful, we're not the line department. We're not one of the national departments. We are a constitutional structure. Just because we were operating at underneath the radar because of other successive ministers coming. I said to the Minister of Finance last week, not long we can operate underneath the radar. Because there are certain things that require us to challenge the current status quo when it comes to the economic and fiscal policy questions and things. That's what we said to them when they had a meeting with them. So this is not an academic research. Academic desktop is a research that we call it. It's a praxis. It's the connection between policy practice and researching it in relation to where we need to go. So there's issues of scientific model that we're using relative to the policies and the practices going on over the years. Why am I saying that? Because every year we're going to come into submissions to this forum, the institutional forum. We are actually giving you information to be able to take up the case, if you agree with us, on behalf of South African citizens. When the ministers, when cabinet comes to you, when the officials come to you, if you just look at all our representations, submissions we've made to you over the last 20 years, and if you go to each one when you meet with a committee or department and just search for them, you can ask them the questions that we've raised in every year's submission. With this Parliament, as many times are taking up the questions, the comments, the recommendations that we've made to you, and the same with the legislators. Last week I reminded the legislators, almost at Comrade Chair, but what I won't say, is that I said to them that you're saying to us every year we're making the same recommendations or we don't make changes. Have you ever noticed or wondered that your Ministry of Finance sits in the Budget Council, which is a council of the Minister of Finance and all the MSCs in the country. Your Executive Mayor sits in the Budget Forum with the Ministers of Finance and is discussing the fiscal and economic framework every year. Have you ever considered that your Premier sits in the Presidential Council Committee? And there they are, this discussion on the same. Have you ever considered that Parliament's portfolio committees and the LEC committees are also part of the process, like yourself, in looking at the recommendations going forward? So the point is, you yourself are to blame for not taking up some of the recommendations we're giving you year on year, either to influence or to change or to keep accountable. So there's a leadership question here. So I'm saying every time I said what Stephen has said, people talk about leadership. And they talk about political leadership. Do they ever consider they're actually talking about themselves in Parliament? Because all of you are in the discourse of the political discussion. You are the political leadership. Because you are the 400 odd people that make this, the political contestation in South Africa. So the issue is, we're presenting you with these information, and you need to take this and hopefully if you agree with us,
ask the right questions to be able to make sure that we can address inequality in the country, that we can address those historic backlogs that we find in some of our provinces, which are so many. Some of our provinces, the same thing when we used to run away from the police and the security forces, the same stuff is told. What is happening here? Is it only about the corruption and fraud, but it's also about the system that's inherited, the system itself, people, quality, other forms of capabilities that's required in it. So I thought that's important to say, because our team spends like a full year looking at what's going on in the country. Next year we're coming with a submission to you to say, we have looked at all the submissions that we've made and the recommendations. And we're going to put it in front of Parliament to say, you as Parliament have not taken up these things. And if you're not taking up these things, how can you keep the executive accountable when they make certain economic and fiscal decisions? Because we've given you advice. We told you in 2001 that as Parliament, there needs to be a cost of norms approach. Meaning, if you deliver education, what is the cost of education? What is the input cost? Because there are lots of factors. There's schools, there's books, there's teachers, there's the land, there's water, there's sanitation, etc. What is the input cost? What is the throughput cost? And what is the outcome of the education sector? And we use the same for all the other sectors. So we're saying the measures that we're taking to the provinces is the same. So we're going to try to be consistent around that. When Honorable Zamani, we think that you're right. We also think that this what we represent, what we've done, is that we're saying there's a need to repackage, re-engineer fiscal policy and intervention. Right? The solutions of 1994 is no longer appropriate in 2017. So there's a need to strongly look at how do departments and governments and provinces reprioritize. And in a real sense, it's not about Umarava from one chief directorate in a department to another chief director. No, it's about what is the investment that needs to be made in relation to social services and other forms of economic services to make those changes. Because the Treasury, we have never decided the Treasury, but if the Treasury speaks the truth, then we have to confirm the truth. The Treasury has been asking year after year for reprioritization. As the reprioritization happens, we're not sure. Do you want us to search for the evidence of that? Of course we can go do that. But we will do it on the basis of our constitutional responsibility. We're suggesting that it's supposed to be an increase in spending on infrastructure. Because infrastructure-led growth would help us to make services cheaper. And even Honorable Blanche, you Honorable Zamani, I don't know which political party you are. There's an agreement on the infrastructure issue that both of you are raising. Because on the one hand, if infrastructure investment is made, it has a spillover to cheaper business services. It has a spillover to cheaper services that people need to buy. So that's the connection there. We are saying that there's a need to, manage the pressures that urban areas and urban cities are going to experience. And part of managing those pressures is that if we don't, it's going to be increased instability. And instability is going to lead to social protests and unrest, and stuff will go on and on. So there's a need to manage that. So part of it is both the human settlement responding to it adequately, is education responding to those pressures, is how they're responding to those pressures, is transport network responding to those pressures. So those are the things. But last year we said to you, it's not going to help to focus on the urban areas, you also need to focus on the rural areas. Because there's an interconnect between the two, and the numbers shows that. So there's a need to look at that. So we're reconfirming what you're saying. The details are in the full book, because we don't have the numbers, the time that goes through. So if you look at 2015 recommendations, 2016 recommendations, this is a recommendation, you'll get the whole picture there. Chair, the question of on learner mobility, I'm going to ask Sasha Peters to respond to that, and
Honorable, first question I'm going to ask Dr. Ramos to respond to.
Please proceed.
I think just to start with, the Honourable Member mentioned that money following the census, the allocation following the census did not recognise the growing population in KZN. In that chapter of our submission, we focused on three case studies. So we looked at the Eastern Cape Limpopo and Gauteng. Eastern Cape and Limpopo because they were the biggest sending provinces, and Gauteng is the biggest receiving province, so we didn't look specifically at KZN. But I have, it could be that according to the budget review, official data views annually to update the PEF formula. But to ensure smoothness and stability, the effects of those data updates it's phased in over the MTF period, specifically in year three of the MTF. So it could be that those are still coming online. So we'll see the effects in year three of the MTF. Then with respect to Ramos, are you asking the integrated term?
Okay, the issue was on one of the slides we talk about that it's unclear whether the pattern of growth has been proper or not. And what that is referring to is a well-known discussion in policy circles on whether the structure of economic growth in South Africa has benefited the majority. And it turns out from our analysis that the question is not cut and dried at all, because when you look at the episodes of economic growth that we've experienced, particularly up to 2008, and you can extend to the current period, what those who talk about jobless growth forget is that there's also been generation of some growth, maybe not sufficient enough to eliminate poverty and inequality, but that doesn't mean there hasn't been creation of jobs. So what that tends to do is, if you focus on that economic growth is one element of a generating jobs, if you say there's jobless growth, then you may eventually find yourself de-emphasizing the role that economic growth plays. So what we're saying there is economic growth is but one of the many instruments for job creation, and we must never forget that it should continue to be a point of emphasis for pro-growth. So that's what that slide essentially is talking through, that when we look at the numbers and backtrack, the evidence runs either way. In fact, we find the responsiveness or the relationship between economic growth and job creation to be 0.5, what they call an employment output elasticity. In other words, for 1% economic growth, you get 0.5% increase in jobs. So it's not a one-on-one relationship, but every 1% economic growth creates 0.5% of your jobs. Or if you grow by 2%, then your jobs grow by 1%. And you don't want to throw away that 1% you are creating anyway. Instead, you want to focus on the other levers for job creation without losing economic growth. Then the Honourable Member also asked for how long we've been making recommendations to COFTA around consolidation. For this particular recommendation that calls for consolidation of the urban development grants in the context of integrated urban development framework, this is the first set of those kinds of recommendations directed particularly at COFDA. So next year when the Division of Revenue Bill papers are tabled, we'll be able to see what their response to this recommendation is going to be. Then I think your comment on the credit rating of municipalities, it's also a puzzle to us, because we see the value add of having a domestic credit rating system that you utilize particularly for those purposes. And to be sure, there was previously such an arrangement, but it fell away. There was Inca. Inca was beginning to think along those lines of doing a domestic credit rating system for municipalities. But with initiatives that are not institutionalized in the public space, when it fell away, that whole system disappeared, which is why we're recommending that if arrangements could be made, that through the Development Bank of Southern Africa, where you institutionalize this credit rating system, it may have some permanency and sustainability, where continually we can generate a credit rating system for municipalities going forward. Then there was a question around exactly what we mean in lay terms about an integrated urban, an integrated urban transport system. And in its essence, this is a system that is essentially about connectivity. A transport system that connects where people reside, where they work, and where their children go to school, and where they access hospital services. That's the integration that we're talking about. So it's, again, linking up with that compact city idea, that the whole concept of urban development, urbanization, is about connecting, is about connectivity, where you don't want disjunctures between where you live, and where you work, and where you access your services. And because there is a government or through its various layers that helps with planning these services, there is no good reason why we should have that disjuncture or that dealing between where people live or reside and where they access services as well as jobs. So we're seeing urban development, urbanization, as an issue of connectivity. And once we get the connectivity, then we're getting our compact cities, and we in fact can reduce the cost of service provision that then comes to, well, what is this submission saying about me as a business person? What is it that would make me want to set up a business or invest? When there is connectivity, or when the cost of services falls through smart infrastructure provisions such as those, and where your land values start rising, we think that sets the climate or the tone for spending on business development. We also think a stable macroeconomic environment, which is the consolidation that we're talking about in the first chapter, is as well important for setting the climate for business to get confidence in the whole system to start the business investment that we so depend on for a sustainable economic growth going forward. Thank you.
Are you done?
Yes.
Stephen?
Thank you, Chair. Let me comment very briefly. Firstly, an apology from my Director General and DDG for them not being able to be here. They're at a the senior meeting of technical officials preparing for the budget. I'm sure you'd understand. We are at the moment busy processing the government responses to the FFC's recommendations. As you know, as the chair mentioned, we tabled them with the Division of Revenue Bill in February. We respond to all those recommendations that are directly and indirectly related to the Division of Revenue in the bill, and we refer all unrelated recommendations to the relevant departments. We've received most of the comments from provinces on the bill, and from most but not all departments, so I wouldn't want to comment on any specific recommendations at this stage because we're still processing and consolidating, and we'll then circulate our draft responses within government as well. So it's quite an extensive process that I think the committee should be aware of that we go through to get a proper government-wide response to these recommendations, and I think it's also important to note that we do take the recommendations very seriously. One thing just to share with the committee and the FFC that has come through in the responses we've received, people have said these recommendations seem very urban biased. I don't think they read from the beginning of the book where it says that this year is an urban-focused theme and last year was a rural-focused theme. From the Treasury side, we really appreciate that kind of themed approach because it helps to stimulate the conversation not just around the minutiae of the individual recommendations but around that broader theme, and it helps us to respond to that kind of set of issues as well. So in the budget review this year, you would have noticed that there was a graph that showed the distribution of the Division of Revenue allocation to rural versus urban provinces and rural versus urban municipalities. And part of the reason that graph was there was that the FFC had stimulated a conversation about how we're allocating funds to rural areas. And that made us as Treasury want to go back and examine what we're doing, what is the distribution of resources, and then to publish that information to assist in that, to make that information available essentially to help the broader debate. So I'm sure in this year's MCBPS, for example, you're likely to see more of a discussion around the kind of urban themes that are coming through here. And lastly, one thing that struck me today in listening to the recommendations all at once, that there is a bit of a tension between some of the recommendations, and I think it might go to what the committee can expect to see from government response in the MCBPS changes and then in the formal response in February. There are some very strong recommendations around the consolidation of grants, and in the full chapter on own revenue in municipalities. But there were also, as they were presenting, a lot of recommendations that recommended a specific grant for a specific thing, I'm sure this is ringing a bell, or a specific fund for a specific thing, which runs a little bit counter to that other recommendation towards the consolidation of grants. And the Treasury strongly supports the consolidation, and also, as you heard last week, the drive to get urban municipalities to raise more own revenue, use all of those instruments, and to be more own revenue funding, especially on their infrastructure budget, which is a little bit in tension with the idea that for every policy objective, and I think we agree with the FFC broadly on most of the policy objectives that they're aiming to achieve, but we're not necessarily going to agree, I shouldn't preempt, that a specific grant for that purpose is necessarily the right way to accomplish that policy objective, because we have that more kind of integrated approach that I think the committee and us have a good understanding of. So in the MCBPS and in the budget response, you're likely to see us agree on the objective, not necessarily on the instrument, but I shouldn't preempt the response. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, National Treasury. Honourable members, we are running out of time. I noted Honourable Essar, you wanted a short follow-up. Dr. Mateme, done. 30 seconds.
30 seconds. I was just looking at this book.
62, under summary and recommendations, the last paragraph on the right at the bottom. I'm not going to read the entire paragraph, but what gives the lends lots of food for thought is that the issue of incentives and disincentives only came out strongly during interviews, but there was a glaring absence in the strategies reviewed. None of the policies reviewed had funding attached to them. Table 8 depicts the overall summary of findings of the policy content analysis. Now, it's amazing or very surprising indeed that when you interrogate and sit, and then none of this is available at a meeting when you discuss this with the metros, it tells you the level of commitment. And this is seriously, I mean, as the gentleman alluded to, problem lays with us in that how serious are we going to take these matters, and to what extent are we going to hold these metros or municipalities accountable? I just wanted to highlight that. Thank you.
We call them to come and account, Dr. Matema.
Thank you very, very much. On the methodology, I just want to know whether we have a factor chairperson which helps us to know what is in that dark corner. I've used Musina as an example, that the non-South Africans for sure outnumber the South Africans, but then when we research and plan, do we have a way of estimating at least to know in this dark corner here, we don't know how many people, but for sure the usage of the services, would somewhat exist. Say, okay, so many South Africans, but the tablets which have been consumed at this clinic by far outnumber the South Africans. So do we have that factor?
Are you able to revise Prof. Blankis? Dr. Ramos?
So what the doctor is referring to is this granulated information right on the For us, we mainly rely on Statistics South Africa data. And Statistics South Africa will have small area samples that we can get with the usual confidentiality clauses, of course. But we can subpoena or access that data. And depending on a specific area that the doctor may want us to run into, we can up to so far as Statistics South Africa capabilities are concerned, be able to zoom in onto that. And I think for small area examples, they could go to as recent as 2015 for the purposes that you are looking towards. But as the Financial and Fiscal Commission, we don't have capacity to maintain those kinds of granular data sets.
Stephen, do you want to come in? None? Honourable members, thank you. We appreciate the presentation. Very important, members, on page 12, slide 12. Development planning, coordination, and state capacity are important for achieving results. You remember Malaysia? What did you hear from Pamandu? The same sentence. I made a note of it in my notes. It brings us back to what does the market want? It wants skills. So we must develop the skills the market wants to grow the economy and connect with the private sector. On the 4th of July, morning 8 o'clock, Investec made a very important announcement, facilitating creating 1 million internships.
for young people across the spectrum of the private sector. 80 organizations listed on the JSE. In cooperation with the national government. It's our task to see if this thing being implemented. That's why we asked the question to 9 provincial treasuries and 9 MECs. Are you taking the CEO initiative further in your province? What was the reply? Yes, on a sectoral basis. It's a bit limping. That's where we come in as legislators. When we engage with our provinces, are we going back when? On the 15th of November to do the briefing on the Division of Revenue Management Bill. That's the opportunity to put this on the table. So, honourable members, coordination is very important in our work. If I refer, I'm referring you to page 13 of the research document. Yolanda, thank you very much, Yolanda Brown, for what you've done here. Issues for consideration by the Select Committee on Appropriations. And this must be filtered into our committee program. The committee to receive briefings on key issues by means of the following scheduled hearings. And there I can list it. Precisely what was highlighted in the presentation. So for the management meeting, there is the agenda. I'm not going into all the details. We'll deal with that in the management meeting. On the members. Receiving this presentation by the Select Committee, by the FFC, and the Select Committee of Appropriations considered the submission of the FFC on the Division of Revenue Bill for 2018-19. Tabled in terms of Section 9.1 of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act 1997. And the first week hereby reports that it has taken note of the contents of this submission, which will be incorporated in the committee's report on the 2018 Division of Revenue Bill. I put this to the committee, but the deliberations here today will be captured in our minutes for our next meeting. I put this then to the committee. Can I get a move for this report? Honorable Issa, can you go on the record?
Chairperson, I move that the report be adopted.
Thank you, Honorable Issa. Can I get a seconder for that? Honorable Gaila, can you go on the record? Thank you, honorable members. Prof. and your team, you are released as I promised. And I said it will be before 12:30, so you are before 12:30 released. And thank you for honoring this important engagement. And all the members, the FFC is busy visiting provinces. Connect with your province, hear when is the date, if possible, join them. Let we also from our side enhance this program. Thank you to Stephen from the Treasury. We're going to see your face quite a lot now until the end of October, end of November, sorry. You are released. Members, there's another matter which my general.
Chairperson, I would like to note, if you'd allow me to say, Prof. Thank you, Prof. I think it was a very progressive report in terms of how you see things on the broader scale. And yeah. I think that you're going to be Mpopo, you're welcome to ask all of them to join me.
Honourable members, the minutes we have to deal with, is it the 1st of August? The 1st of August. I need your attention, please. That was the briefing by the National Treasury on the Building Productive, Inclusive and Sustainable Cities. Consideration of the draft minutes of 28 June 2017 and update on the Study 2 and program. I put to you page 1. Minutes of 1st of August 2017. Are your names spelled correctly, etc.? I put to you.
Just as
an assignment
of the second
thought
of the.
Who? Now, Stephen? No, no. Page 2, honourable members. Page 3. Page 4. And page 5. Can I get a mover for adoption for the minutes of the 1st of August, honorable members? Who were there? Stabir, Mudaram, Shimping, Zamandi, Tablan, Skater. Some of you, honorable Tablan, moves for adoption. The seconder for the minutes, seconder for adoption, honorable Mudaram.
Thank you.
Honourable members, I requested the Secretariat to circulate to you the reply by the National Treasury, by the Minister of Finance, referring to the Ouer Tambo District Municipality, that intervention, as well as the reply by the Provincial Treasury, Eastern Cape. So please read it. We are contemplating, as we indicated when we engaged with the District Municipality, Treasury, National, Provincial, Proctor, etc., to visit our Tambo District Municipality. We will see how this will be practical possible, looking at the NCP program for the fourth term, October, November, beginning December. Secondly, on the 10th of October, as I mentioned in last week when we were there with the Reserve Bank, there will be an engagement in Cape Town by the Monetary Policy Forum, and I've got the invitations here. Can you please assist and just distribute to members, because I want you, I'm requesting you members, that you return this completed to the Secretariat, if possible, before you leave Cape Town this week. Because we are only coming back in the beginning of October, and these people must make their arrangements. It is in Cape Town, it is at the Table Bay Hotel, Breakwater Boulevard, Victorian, Alfred, Waterfront, so there's the waterfront. And it's the evening of Tuesday, the 10th of October, 18 hours. So please reply to that and send it through to the Secretariat. Secretariat, please follow up. Say on Friday morning.
Thank you, sir. Then you can tell us on the Monday.
The Monday?
Yeah, because we are on the provincial week that week, on the 10th. So let's get clarity on that one.
Is it the provincial week?
Yes. From the 9th.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So. All right. That's a pity. The NCOP program, there was a chairs and webs meeting this morning. There will be a formal program meeting tomorrow, and we are having a meeting after the program meeting as a select committee of preparations, and Honorable Matara, as our whip, will then take us through the latest development in terms of the NCOP program, taking us up to the first week in December. Honourable Member, thank you. Secretary.
Chair,
before you speak about
a workshop on Friday.
Yes, I requested Chief Work to send us all an email, because this was a verbal notification that we get it in writing. Yes, there is a workshop on Friday morning. You're right, Honourable Trailer. There will be a workshop on Friday morning where national departments, if I remember now correctly, you must assist me, will come and brief us on development programs and challenges in provinces, refer- far referring to the specific topic. But that's all I can say now. I don't have any content because there were no any content. We're going to see that Friday morning, 8 o'clock until I think 12 or 12:30. But I requested that a mail be sent out. We're waiting for the email. I can't say anything more. Luba Baru? It's not okay then.
Can you look at the date for over time of the matter of urgency?
Say again?
The date for over time of the matter.
Yes, it's urgent. I hope that we can answer you tomorrow during our meeting of preparations. I'll engage this afternoon with Honorable Motara, and I think it will just be appropriate that we have a joint management meeting. But we can deal with that. Right, let's try again.
No, thank you, gentlemen. In fact, my interest is with respect to the Oatambo issue. I thought the committee was going to discuss it. The reason why I requested the opportunity to say something about this Oatambo thing, I based on the documents that have been submitted to the committee now regarding that case and the steps that the committee has followed since the matter was referred to the committee, the direction between the committee and the municipality, including the provincial and national department, which led to the drafting of the report which was adopted by the committee. My worry, of which I may be wrong, is the question of time. That particular issue, my feeling is that it has been overtaken by events. So I'm not sure if it will be worthwhile for the committee to go to Oatambo specifically for that issue. If I were to provide an advice, I would recommend that if my observation is correct, and of course the committee allows that, as much as there was that matter, the objective of going to Oatambo and the aims, maybe we might need to revise and not go for that particular issue and look for a week maybe going to Oatambo so that we can go and see a lot of things and not go there for that. 2 days might not be enough for me if we change the objective. But if the committee insists that the visiting Oatambo should only focus on that issue, and then now it brings me back to the question of time and issue of the actual withdrawal of that MIG grant, which happened in the financial year, of which now we are in another financial year, there's been like new allocations. So I'm looking at it from that angle, and I was like, I need to maybe trigger a discussion within the committee about that, based on my view.
I've got 45 seconds to get to my meeting. Yes, on the moment.
No, Jefferson, I was going to agree with him. I think we must also look at the Auditor General's report, that which to full extent close to a billion of any. Thank you.
No, we will have a management meeting about the fourth term program. We must see what is practical possible. We must bear in mind NCLP is going back to the Eastern Gate for a report back of a whole week. I don't know which areas will be visited, I'm not sure. Maybe we are in the vicinity of the district municipality that we can incorporate that. But we will discuss that with the chief whip, etc., and leadership designing that program.
Honourable members, this brings us to the end of the business of this meeting. This meeting is adjourned. We see each other tomorrow, 10 o'clock. Where? Where are we tomorrow?
Tomorrow's meeting is going to be in 90 plans.